Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, indeed two great ideas, I think. We're going to talk to a young guy. Bob, just when like punk kids get you down.
I know.
You got somebody like Sam Levin, who is so not the punk kid and fills you up and like gives you optimism. But Sam is part of Project Sprout. He and a couple of friends of his at his school in Massachusetts, Monument Mountain High School, in fact, started a garden there at school. It's grown. Now they've sort of spread and helped facilitate other schools in the area to get on board, watch Project Sprout grow, if I may say.
Sure.
He's part of the slow food movement. You know, we've got Slow Food Bluegrass here with Mark Williams as the convivium leader. But he's part of that up in his part of the country. He was just here for the Healthy Foods Local Farms Conference that took place this weekend. But, you know, an emerging face and such a young face.
Yeah, it's great. Some kids just have it.
Yeah.
And I used to envy those in high school.
Did you beat them up? I hope not.
Thank you very much. No, but, you know, I was a jock who was, I think, liked and popular for all the wrong reasons. And a kid like this should be liked and loved for all the right reasons.
Yeah, it sounds like he is. So.
Yeah, so, and he is, and he's doing a great job. And I bet we'll hear from this guy for the next 40 years.
I'd say so. And we're going to have him on Homegrown coming up here in a little bit. So we're delighted to have Sam. And great idea, a little closer to home.
Yeah.
Botanica's finally getting one step closer to making their dream come true in terms of having a botanical garden in Louisville.
Yeah, this idea has been around. I remember 30 years ago, there was a woman who started a botanic garden in a small greenhouse across from Cave Hill Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And the idea has floated around ever since and finally got a little foothold here, I hope, so to speak. Botanica has got some land, a site along River Road where Frankfort Avenue comes in.
Kind of an extension of Waterfront Park, too,
I think. And it'll be... maybe, hopefully, finally, the Botanic Garden Louisville and Conservatory Louisville certainly deserves and should have.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to go down there and meet the folks from Botanica and see what's going on at this site. That's coming up today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I found a way to live forever.
Oh, have you?
I did.
Yeah?
I think about it all the time. Plant tulips.
Plant tulips?
Then you have to wait to spring to see them come up.
You have to.
Yes, I sincerely believe that.
Okay.
I mean, I was planting tulips. Janet and I, we planted them in different places. We're kind of surprising each other where they're going to come up next year.
That's
we didn't
a good idea.
Tell each other where they were. Uh-huh. It's going to be fun. I used a lot of containers I hadn't used before. But in the middle of the process, I thought, no, I got to live until April now so I can see them come up.
Mm-hmm.
I'll do this next October.
It's not as good as living for your grandkids to be born, but it's close.
It's a lot cheaper, I think.
Yeah. You may be right about that.
Live forever, plant some tulips. So that's exactly what I did, and I'm all excited about where Janet planted hers. It's going to be fun to wander around.
I think that's a great idea.
And see where they sprout up.
As long as nobody mows them down.
I'm sure mine's in a much more beautiful sight than she ever did, but we'll find out. How about the Wishy Estate? What's up?
Well, speaking of things that don't live forever...
Yeah.
Andy got the chainsaw out last weekend.
Uh-oh.
And we cut down some of the old apple trees.
Oh.
And, you know, we cut the ones down that were like half dead anyway. Mm-hmm. But honestly, Bob, there were quite a few that we were sort of forced to cut down even though we didn't really want to, because it's that more serious stage of like fire blight, which you often see on just the foliage or the tips. But there were like whole large sections of branches that looked like they'd been torched.
Yes.
And then decay starts to begin, you know, on the top part of the branch. So the whole tree's just sort of like a festering wound all the time. And it's also houses the disease. So if we don't cut them down, that disease is always going to be present in the garden and it's going to make it harder for the other stuff that's there. So some were cut down just because they had so many lesions, if you will, and burn spots on them that it was best to kind of get them out of the garden. And then that'll give everybody else a better chance, hopefully.
It's funny you mention that because we did exactly the same thing. I mentioned before transplanting peonies. Well, we cut down some trees to open up the area, and one of the trees to go was an old apple tree.
Yeah.
It was just time.
Yeah.
That's part of gardening.
It is. And like, you know, so much dead or dying back or disease, it's not going to rejuvenate itself. You know what I mean?
You got your saplings and you got your chainsaws, the yin and the yang of gardening.
Exactly. And, you know, it's one of those practices too, just in terms of disease and pest management when it comes to orchards, is that you have to do it from time to time. So we'll see what happens. And today, or this year too, Bob, was such a disease pressure year because of all the rain.
Yeah, right.
We probably had more of an incidence in there than we have in the past. So anyway, the job's done. We'll have some good smelling firewood.
Yep.
And all that apple wood.
You won't miss the trees.
No, we won't.
Once
we got
they're
plenty
gone,
of others.
2 weeks later, I never miss them.
No. Exactly. You're right about that, actually.
Yeah, move on.
All righty. If you've got any gardening events that are going on this fall, let us know. You can go to our website at wfpl.org and send us the information that way, and we'd be happy to broadcast it. In the meantime, we've got Sam Levin on the phone, excited to talk about Project Sprout. Sam is a high school student at Monument Mountain High School in Barrington, Massachusetts, where he and some other students initiated a school garden that continues to feed the students at the school. This year, Project Sprout has spread to other schools under Sam's direction. And Sam was just recently here in Louisville for the Healthy Food Local Farms Conference, you know, talking about all of this exciting stuff that they're doing. So we wanted to share it with our listeners as well. Sam, welcome to Homegrown and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listen, first, give us some perspective on what came first for you in terms of food, your involvement with food. You know, was it at home? Was it getting involved in the slow food movement? Was it school? Was it peer pressure?
Well, first, I don't know, I guess I have to go back pretty far. My grandfather was a farmer, a potato farmer out in Long Island. And I worked on his farm with my brothers as a kid during the summers. And then for the rest of the year, right down the road from my house was a little farm with a few animals, and almost every day after school, I would go there and hang out and play with the animals and stuff. So I've always been connected to animal farms, and I've also, the thing I've really cared most about in my life has always been the natural world and biology. And actually, at the beginning of my freshman year, I got to teach a biology class down at the elementary school, and I wasn't allowed to bring the kids outside. And
wow.
It just blew my mind, because I was like, I'm teaching these kids about the natural world, and yet I can't bring them to actually see it.
Sam, talk about your slow food connection. Here you are, 15 years old, and you're speaking at a worldwide conference in Tierra Madre, Italy, with thousands of delegates. What was that like?
It was fun.
Was it scary?
It was scary at first. I mean, really, I was just asked to tell my story. So in that sense, I was just kind of getting up there and talking about some things I'd done and some things I'd been a part of. So it was scary at first, but more than anything, it was energizing. You know, like you're in that room, there are thousands of people around you. A lot of them are young like you, and they're all working towards the same goals, have the same values, want the same thing in the world. And it's a pretty exciting moment and feeling, I think.
Now, did you reach out to Slow Food, or did they find you?
It was one of those sort of, it was a mutual, we met in the middle, kind of.
Okay.
When Natalie and Sarah and I were first starting the project, I called this farmer just by getting his name from like the phone book of looking up farmers, and started talking to him and asking for him advice and telling him about our idea, and he happened to be the head of the local slow food chapter.
So, okay, let's, I guess we need to step back just a tad bit from the slow food experience in Italy in terms of what your story is and what brought you there. So let's talk about Project Sprout. What made your story such a great story and all these people want to hear it? Tell us what you did.
Well, when I was a freshman, early in the year, I started to talk with people about local food and getting local food in the lunchroom, and I met in these environmental meetings we're having at the school. I met these two girls, Natalie and Sarah. Natalie was a sophomore and Sarah was a junior, and they had been thinking about the same things and talking too. And so, together, we just decided. Well, we actually first talked about getting local food into the cafeteria, and then we started thinking, why not skip the gap, you know, between the farm and the cafeteria, and have a garden, have a farm right at the school, and that's how it began. It was cool because we were kind of naive and we didn't really worry about how impossible it would be, and so we just decided we would do it and went from there.
So what was that like going from there? Okay, obviously the school has land around it, so you had the ability to do it just in that logistical sense, but, you know, who's planting it, who's cultivating it, who's weeding it, who's harvesting it, who's cooking it, who's eating it now?
Well, there was a, there's a step before that.
Okay.
we started telling people what we wanted to do, and we started talking about this big garden, and like you said, having kids run it. And the first reaction of everyone, of almost everyone, was, "Hey, you guys are kids. You're not going to be able to do this. Huh. Like, we can, you know, high schoolers. You guys play video games. How can we?" You know, so
you showed them.
We spent several months trying to overcome that obstacle and getting approval of our school to use the land, and coming up with a concrete, detailed plan that would show that, you know, we were serious about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you said, from there, we knew we wanted to be student run. More than anything, we knew it had to come from the students. It couldn't be top down. It couldn't be, you know, we couldn't be told we had to do it. We couldn't get credit for it. It just had to be students stepping up, mm-hmm. By their own volition and making things happen.
And there's an article on the Slow Food website about this, what you went through. And you were convinced the school committee would turn you down. The adults would not let you do it.
Yeah, I was pretty nervous. I mean, a lot of people had told us that they were going to say no. And we'd gotten, you know, my family and everyone had been preparing me to just be ready for them to say no. And that seemed hard because we had already worked for so long, worked so hard, and we'd just become ingrained in us. You know, mm-hmm. Sarah, Natalie, and there, by then there were a few other kids involved, Ben and Kurt. And so by then we just felt like we had to do this no matter what, and how could anyone tell us that we couldn't, you know? Mm-hmm.
And then you found an old soccer field across from the high school, and it went from there.
Yeah.
So how big is it now?
Now, this is our second season.
Mm-hmm.
This year, the vegetable plot is 12,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And next to that, we have an orchard of heirloom fruit trees, 24 mm-hmm. trees.
That's what's so forward-thinking about it, actually, is that the students are taking complete responsibility. You're not getting credit for it. You know, like, ooh, well, I'm only going to do this if I get extra credit kind of thing. So it's pure in that sort of way. But is there any fear that once you all have graduated, that the same enthusiasm, you know, won't persist with the students that come after you? Or is there a mechanism in place to make sure that that doesn't happen?
Well, there's definitely that fear, and there definitely was more of that fear, especially last year. Two, you know, key leaders of the project, Sarah, mm-hmm. who's one of the founders, and Aaron, were seniors last year, so they were graduating, and that led us to start thinking about, like you said, what comes next? What happens when we're gone? And I spent a lot of the summer worrying about that. But last year, in our second year, a freshman new to the high school got interested and joined, and at first, you know, she wasn't that involved. She was new, and now one of the key leaders, one of the strongest leaders of the project.
Oh, great.
We have 12 middle schoolers who come twice a week and work. You know, two of them now are going to come to a board meeting for the first time. So I no longer am really scared of that at all.
Good. So the momentum's there.
So many young kids, elementary schoolers, hundreds of elementary schoolers mm-hmm. come to the garden every week, and I know that this will stay alive from that.
Mm-hmm. So to give us an idea of what it's like, Sam, a day in the life of the garden there at the high school and harvesting the food and then actually getting it, you know, to the cafeteria.
Well, there are three main branches of our project.
Okay.
It's the garden, cafeteria, and outreach. So right now, the way it works is that we are working in the garden every day after school. I have basketball, so actually 2 days a week I'm not there, but someone is there, or a few people are there every day after school, and a bunch of people, like between, you know, 10 and 25 people come on Saturdays.
Mm-hmm.
That's the work in the garden. And then Tuesdays and Thursdays, a group of about 10 people go before school and harvest and bring it up to the cafeteria, and then the cafeteria prepares the food and cooks it, you know, cooks it and serves it.
So
and then the rest of the time is spent fundraising, spreading the word, organizing, and planning. I'm the head of outreach and education, so that's
okay.
During the winter, that's why I spend my time.
Okay. So did you have to get some of the people in the cafeteria on board? You know what I mean? And like the stereotypical cafeteria food, you know, you open the jars and, you know, everything's sort of prefab to a certain degree, right?
Yep.
So now it's a whole different ball game for these folks. Was it met with enthusiasm that, wow, we get to actually, you know, cook with some real food and fresh food? Or was it met with a little consternation of, hey, wait a minute, this is going to, you know, make our job a little more difficult, perhaps?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
The way it started was, we went to the head of food service program, and like you said, yeah, it's frozen packages that get heated up and, you know, and served. We went to her, and she was like, hey, it's a great idea. I love the idea of local food. I want people to be healthy, but I just don't have the time mm-hmm. to do this, and they're not given the time or the workforce to make sure. This happen, to cook real food. And so the first reaction was sort of like, I don't know if we can make this happen, but she was like, let's try a salad. If you want, you can try a salad. And we did it. And at the high school, they normally serve between 4 and 6 salads. And that day, with the Project Sprout vegetables that the kids had grown, they sold over 70.
Wow.
So that was like our first hurdle. They were like, wow, kids want this. Maybe mm-hmm. this is worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And then this summer, Natalie started meeting with the head of food service program like once a week and talking to her and giving her ideas. And finally, after seeing that we were committed and that we had done this for 2 years and the garden was growing, she said, let's do it. I'll take all your produce.
Awesome.
And it was this amazing transformation.
Wow.
And she started looking up recipes for kohlrabi and soybeans.
That's right.
I walk through the cafeteria and I see Swiss chard and tomatillo salsa.
Awesome.
And when we deliver food, the food service, the people working in the kitchens are excited. They say, oh, kale, I love kale. Or, bring me more leeks. I'm going to try to make potato leek soup. And you remember that, you know, that job sucks in the sense that it doesn't pay well and it's a long hours and a lot of stress. But they picked it because they like food.
They like food.
They like cooking.
Sure.
And so it's been this amazing transformation for all of us to see that happen.
And Sam, not just within the school, again, going back to the online story, your first benefit was a pig roast, all local food donated by local farmers. 300 community members show up, and you raise $9,000, which is remarkable for anybody anywhere. Has that enthusiasm been maintained outside the school, too?
Yeah, so we were totally shocked by that because we wanted to maybe raise a few $1,000, get some people to, you know, try some local food and talk about it, and like you said, 300 people. So we thought, hey, let's do it again, and let's see if we can get the farms to donate even more.
Mm-hmm.
And the farms said, we love what you're doing, you're, you know, cultivating new farmers, supporting our business, yeah, we'll give you more food. The restaurant that hosted it the first time agreed to do it again. We lowered the ticket price to be able to invite more people from the community.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, we actually had 500 people show up and raised $11,000.
Wow.
And, you know, it's another one of those things that people want this. People want good food. People want to be healthy and want to be connected to the people, to the farmers in their community. And sometimes the avenues just aren't made apparent to them.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's put in front of them, they'll take it in an instant.
So you guys are trying to get the same sort of programs implemented in other schools. How's that going for you? I know your goal was to at least get, 6 schools in 2009. The year's slowly coming to an end, Sam. How many other schools have you been able to touch?
Well, it's funny. I was just talking about this because, you know, at Terra Madre that you mentioned earlier, at the end of my speech, I made this promise. And I said, you know, I promise that we will be the generation that reunites mankind with the earth.
Mm-hmm.
I came home back to my friends, back to those people who work on this, and they were like, wow, good job. Now we actually have to.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I felt that way. I was like, okay, I said this, and I believed it. I believe it, but
right. Will
this actually happen? And we went to our first school in Martha's Vineyard,
mm-hmm.
and we showed up there, and we had this presentation, this video put together by a friend of mine, and we showed it. At their public school, and we showed it at their charter school, and both schools started student-run gardens.
Mm-hmm.
We went to two local schools, showed the presentation. One the garden's already there, growing, and the other has started with a compost program and are hoping to dig up the ground this year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're at 4, and then fifth school in New York State has had a farming program but didn't have a garden that was run by students. They came to the garden a few weeks ago, and now they're starting a student-run section of the
mm-hmm.
farm. And I just got someone just came up to me today asking if we would help with a 6th school.
Mm-hmm.
So we're one away from our number.
All right, not too bad. And the year's not up yet. So, Sam, let me ask you this. You had commented somewhere that you know, the whole slow food movement sometimes is looked at in somewhat what of an elitist way, and you don't want it to be perceived that way, and you want, you know, these experiences to be a unifying factor between all people everywhere. But it does actually seem like there might be some socioeconomic parameters that allow it to work a little more effectively, or might actually make it more challenging in some areas as well. Have you thought about those sorts of issues to where, you know, in maybe in a more urban environment, you could bring some of these programs more practically to them? Or do you think it's really only going to work in certain areas where there is that farmer support and that community support?
I think it's funny because I can't think of anything that's more about social justice than the food movement.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at our school, it's a public school, and the kids, you know, are just like any kids from anywhere in the country, and they've had to, you know, we've had to raise the money from our community.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that, you know, the kids in our school who have money shouldn't be the only ones who come to school with a bag lunch and therefore get healthy food. It's about making good food a right of everyone. And that can happen and should happen everywhere in this country and in this world.
Mm-hmm.
But it can only happen if two things. One is the people who have money and can afford local food need to buy it in order to make local food cheaper for the people who can't get it but deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second piece is that we have to remember growing your own food is not more expensive than buying it from industrial farm.
Mm-hmm.
There are expenses that we don't see when we buy food that looks cheap, when we buy from McDonald's and our health bill goes up. And I think that it's not only not elitist to switch to local food and organic food, but it's really the only option, especially for poor people, especially for people who don't have access easily to local food. Those are the people that need it most, and everyone has to work to make sure they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
What's your advice to other students to get them engaged? How do you keep this ball rolling down the field?
I like to bring them into the garden.
There you go.
Get them to a farm. Because after that, get them to try some food, some local food. Because after that, it's pretty hard to resist. Anyone who's come to the garden, cross-country team runs by, and we wait. We have some carrots ready for them. you know, you try it, and then you want to come back. You try working for a day and busting all day to get something accomplished in the rain or the cold or the wet. And when you finish, you want to come back next Saturday and do it again. And I guess so for the students who haven't gotten involved or who don't know about it yet, that's what I would do. And for the students who want to make something happen already, I would just say that they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've said this before, and I'll say it a million times until everyone's heard it, that we're not special. The group Project Sprout kids are not special. We're like anyone else. Anyone can do this.
Yeah, I mean, congratulations, man. This is just wonderful. Do the other kids have a nickname for you, as high school kids will do? Are you Slow Food Sam or something? Or what?
I don't know. Sometimes I get Sprout Kid or the Garden Boy.
Okay. I've gotten all that my entire life, too, and I'm proud of it. So, yeah, you've done a great job. Thank you. Thank you, Sam. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. No problem.
Sam Levin is a high school student at Monument Mountain High School in Barrington, Massachusetts, where he and some other students, including Natalie Akers and Sarah Stedman, initiated a school garden that continues to grow and feed the students there. This year, Project Sprout has spread to other schools under Sam's direction. Sam was in Louisville for the Healthy Food Local Farms Conference this weekend, spreading the word. Of course, for more information on Project Sprout, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, we head down to the River Road at Frankfort Avenue site to see Louisville's first botanic garden. You're listening to Homegrown at 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And we have journeyed along River Road to where Frankfort Avenue intersects, and we're at the site of hopefully will be a 22-acre Louisville Botanic Garden and Conservatory.
Long awaited, in fact. I know that the folks at Botanic have long talked about this being a goal, and it looks like we've gotten closer than ever before to reaching that Louisville Botanic Garden status for Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah, I think George Rogers Clark had the first idea for this, and we've been kind of waiting 200 years ever since for something to come
for somebody
it.
Else to come along. Like Judy Hunt and her folks at Botanica.
Exactly. We've got two people here who know a lot about this and can explain whether we go west on the Louisville Botanic Garden. Judith Hunt has been president of Botanica since 2001, and Jeannie Curtis is a member of the Ashley and Associates, a Louisville development planner that will assist in the new garden. Judith, let's begin with you. Give us some history on the effort to create a botanic garden in Louisville, and where did Botanica get involved?
Well, Botanica was formed, or actually evolved, from a group of flower societies back in 91 and 92 who got together to do a fundraising and educational event at the old Aikenback Farm in LaGrange. And out of that group, after the second year, we met and we decided that Louisville needed a group that could be kind of a central point for the horticultural community in Louisville, because no one seemed to know what anybody else was doing in the horticulture scene at that time. So we became that. We changed our name from Panorama to Botanica at that time. Then in 1993, we filed for our 501c3. So that was made final in 2000. So we've been around for a number of years now.
Well, that's a good point. Besides the botanical garden, we'll get into it later, your website is probably the only central location in Louisville, Kentuckiana, for what's going on and with who.
Well, we have made a big effort to do that, and we do have a directory with all the local clubs and garden clubs and flower societies and professional organizations listed. We also have a calendar of horticultural events that we offer to any of the nonprofit groups and the historic homes and so forth are welcome to list their events on our website calendar.
So, Judy, give us an example of some of the events that you all have hosted over the past couple of years, because you typically bring gardening names, recognizable people into the community so that people can hear lectures and whatnot.
Right. Well, over the years, for several years, we did bring in speakers, and that was our main focus. Over the last few years, our largest attendance was for John Karloftis, who came in and really gave a real interesting program and is a lot of fun and signed his books and so forth. And in fact, I have been in touch with John, and this is a flash, actually. He's coming back next spring to do another program for us just after his newest book will be out. So,
and he's somewhat of a local boy, right?
Yes, he is. Everybody, and I think in Springs horticulture anyway, in Louisville, really likes John Karloftis. He's a nice kid.
And speaking of gatherings, just about a month ago, Mayor Jerry Abramson and some other city big hitters, for lack of a better phrase, gathered on this 22-acre site along River Road, the site of an old landfill, but it's a nice property. It's elevated. I like that thought. And they announced plans for the Botanical Garden. Tell us about that meeting and how that happened.
Well, let's first sort of give people a good visual understanding of where the location is. In fact, we're sitting in the Sea Ray of Louisville shop. They've allowed us to sit in here because there's a bit of traffic noise outside. But it's high on a hill, right off of River Road, right where Frankfort Avenue comes down to River Road. So it's really a perfect location in terms of an extension of what's happening on waterfront, accessible in that sort of way if you're coming downtown to enjoy all these outdoor, you know, new spaces. So very end of Frankfort Avenue at River Road.
Yeah, like 30 seconds from downtown Louisville.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's walkable or bikeable easily from downtown. And that's one reason that we have worked for so long to obtain this site. It is, I'm told, anyway, it is the only site that is out of the 100-year floodplain that is on the waterfront. So, of course, you can't have a botanical garden in a floodplain unless you just want water gardens. So we feel that it is accessible to not only visitors to Louisville, which it is very accessible, of course, but everyone in the region, because it's so near the interstate system that anyone in the whole region will be easily can get there to visit.
It'll also be part of the Louisville Loop, obviously, the path, the 100-mile trail around Louisville going from downtown out to Floyd's Fork and down, you know, southern part of the city and back around on the west end. So it's a natural fit here.
Oh, it absolutely is. And Louisville is the only city its size in the country that does not have a botanical garden and conservatory. Mm-hmm. So we feel that it's way overdue, and we are so excited that we now finally have this site that is near downtown and at the upper, just beyond the eastern end of Waterfront Park. And Waterfront Development has been very supportive of this project all along. And in fact, our board meets at Waterfront Development in their boardroom monthly. So they've just been very supportive about it.
So Judy, you recently have hosted some other people from other states and cities that have done similar things. What's the feedback that you got from these experts?
We had six directors from botanical gardens all around the country, and Jeannie may have to help me remember their names. I can tell you where they're from. We had Brent Dennis from San Francisco Botanical Garden and Conservatory of Flowers. We had Bruce Harkey from Columbus, Franklin Park Conservatory and Botanical Garden. We had, help me, Jeannie.
Eric Shands from
Powell Gardens in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. We had Bob Brackman from San Antonio Botanic Gardens. Roberta Sladke from Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And they walked the site, and they were, as you said, very impressed. Also had some ideas about sound barriers, because frankly, you know, the interstate does run pretty close to the site, but that's something that can be solved.
Oh, absolutely. And they gave us some very creative ideas about how to mitigate that sound. And it will be incorporated into the garden, and nobody will realize that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. So all in all of these people that are leaders in botanical gardens, conservatories, are optimistic about this particular site. You guys have commitment from the city to get the site. All the details haven't worked out, but you're going to get it. So from this point on, Judy, what needs to be put into place to actually move forward?
We are currently raising funding for a strategic plan, and after that is finished, then we will do our master plan. That will give us a lot more detail and refine the idea. We have a concept right now, which is just that. It was designed specifically for this site a few years ago by Jim Walters at Bravura, and Jim has just been a good friend to us all along. But we will refine that, and it may or may not look like what the concept looks like right now. But in general, we will have a main building with exhibition halls and meeting rooms and a horticultural library and a cafe and the things that you generally expect to find in a botanical garden, along with a lot of different types of gardens outside. And most likely we'll focus on native plants for the most part, and children's gardens, maybe a butterfly house, and the possibilities are limitless at this point. But the master plan will begin to really refine. We'll talk with a lot of people in the community and get their input and their ideas, and then we'll take all that and sit down with a designer, with an architect and a landscape architect, and then begin to really pull things together.
Of course, that'll take a little bit of money, and to talk about that, we're going to bring in Jeannie Curtis of Ashley & Associates, who's helping with the development of this botanical garden along River Road. Well, Jeannie, thanks for joining us, and give us a little background first on how you got involved with this botanical project.
About a year ago, I got a call from Judy that said, I want to talk to you about a project and would like to see if you are interested in helping us. And she came into our office, told me about the project and about the name of the organization, Botanica. And one of the most incredible stories I'd ever heard, and I tell this story often, there was a woman named Helen Harrigan, And she lived on Preston Highway, she and her husband, and had a wonderful garden. And lo and behold, after she passed away, I believe how it goes, the story, or at least how I tell it, how about that, is that that Botanica Judy got a call or a letter saying that Mrs. Harrigan had indeed left 1.7 of her estate, million, to Botanica. And it was for the building of a botanical garden and conservatory.
So that's still sitting in wait for her,
yes,
for her directive to be manifest in a real botanical garden.
Yes, here, right? And I feel like we are honoring Mrs. Absolutely. Harrigan and her husband and her family, and I know Judy does too, as we're embarking on this. There were numerous that were in the early group and that Judy had talked about that didn't have the same vision, it didn't have the same drive and foresight to see that this could be possible. So when I met with Judy and her board members, it was really humbling and awe-inspiring to see that this group of people for perhaps 10 years, and as the mayor said, haven't you all been around for at least 20? I don't think they've been around that long, but that these people were so intent on this goal, that mm-hmm. There will be a botanical garden, and they wanted this particular site. Mm-hmm.
And you had alluded to something interesting, I think, earlier too, when we were touring the site. The fact that it is a very bold idea now at this point has really come together, you know, dramatically, that's what's catching the attention of people, because it's a more serious, committed endeavor.
Well,
although it's really big and will require lots of money.
Yes, the initial, what we're thinking looking ahead, it will be a very large project for Louisville, and it will be a very innovative and creative project. And as when I went to talk with Jim Wood, the president of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, he was so excited that it was his idea to bring in the directors, the six directors, and hear the good, the bad, and the not so good of what they did in their gardens. And how exciting, how often are you able to work on it? It's basically a startup.
From scratch.
Yes, yeah. And it can be designed however the community desires, and there will be community meetings, as Judy mentioned. And community input is wanted and needed, and so it is a very large project, but it is one that will be a signature for Louisville, for the region, and for the state. So it has huge potential, not only in, we hope, as a tourist attraction, of course, but on anticipated revenue coming into the city for our visitors who will choose to live and play and come see us. So it's a huge project, yes.
Yeah, we talked earlier, it could be as much as $40 million if you could walk in tomorrow, everything you wanted, but of course that's way down the road. So where do you begin a project like this? Who do you talk to, and how do you get started?
Well, I thought maybe you were going to give us a check for $40 million, so that we would just go, here it is.
Try to get on the radio.
That's a big deal.
Sorry, Jeannie.
We are talking to, as you start out with a fundraising plan, you are looking for large donors to begin with. So we have numerous requests that are currently out there, and we are talking to foundations and to individuals, those who have indicated that they are interested in this project and would like to be a founding donor to this.
Not to reveal any specifics, but how many are local and how many are like beyond local?
As of now, they're local.
All local.
Yes.
Okay.
And we feel if we were able to provide for them what they are looking for in this botanical garden, we could fund it locally.
Totally locally.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it will have a statewide influence. So we will certainly go to other places.
Well, are there federal initiatives, monies, anything that support the whole botanical garden thing, like a larger network?
Well, we certainly,
or does that come
so
later?
No, I think we're looking as well. We are, as I'm calling it, as a guerrilla fundraising. We are looking every possible place. The good news for us, it's on a landfill. There are, I believe, 17 other botanical gardens across the country that are built on landfills. And because it's built on landfills, there is special monies, environmental programs and all of those coming through.
Land reclamation.
Yes, you're saying land reclamation, mm-hmm. environmental. And because green is so important right now,
and
I feel, yes, every project has a lifespan. And it just took this environment, environmental push, the green interest, all of that for Botanica to come to the forefront. So here we are.
And what's the time frame at this point? Anyway, I think you're working on a 2-year lease with the city. It's not totally negotiated yet, but when do you hope to start something out here? Did you pick a date yet?
Well, the first thing that, yeah, I would love to pick a date, but.
that depends on when your check comes in the mail, Bob.
Yeah,
it's in the mail, by the way.
Mail's a little slow there, Bob. I think that Judy had mentioned already that we're bringing in someone to do the strategic plan. And what that will show is step one, step two. It will be a guided tour, so to speak, of what needs to happen when because of the demands of the site. Mm-hmm. Then once that happens, and we will know monies attached to that once that the board makes a decision and all of that is laid out. So in many ways,
wait for the strategic plan.
Yes, this too shall be revealed.
Okay.
Well, could there somewhat ironically be some environmental issues with the landfill also to deal with before you can even start here?
Well, we have been told, and perhaps Judy can answer this better than I, we have been told that it was, a landfill. However, it was, the refuse was burned, and it burned for a long time so that the toxic products burned off. So that's good news.
It's in the ozone layer right now, not in the soil.
Maybe not so good for those who lived around it at the time, but good for that it has burned off. So there is far less environmental problems than one would anticipate.
Okay. And they can do testing for all of that.
Yes, and they have done some preliminary testing. Mm-hmm. Waterfront Development Corporation has stepped up and done that. Mm-hmm. So
pretty darn exciting stuff. I can't know 200 years or so we're going to have a...
Oh, I think it'll be sooner than that.
I'm going to take the East End Bridge to see the new Louisville Botanical Garden.
That's right. We can walk across the spirally thing.
That's right.
That's right. That'll happen. From your house, probably.
Well, I will say, Jim Wood, when we talked to him about this project, he said the next big thing for Louisville is a Big Four Bridge. So that will be the coolest site ever. Yeah. And that will bring
people... And that's close by.
Yes, and we're on the eastern end of Waterfront Park. Mm-hmm. So that you can come and spend the day, across the Big Four Bridge, come over to the Botanical Garden, maybe decide to get married there, have dinner there, observe the gardens, and enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds great. Well, we'll definitely be waiting to hear what the strategic plan says.
Well, we'll let you know.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you both very much. We appreciate it.
Judy Hunt and Jeannie Curtis are making progress on a new Louisville Botanical Garden and Conservatory. For more information on the garden, go to the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Well, Miss Wishy, we're back safe and sound from Botanica.
We are indeed.
Hopefully we'll become Botanica.
Yes.
We become Botanica.
And now we've got some questions.
Yeah, we do.
This one's from Stuart. He says, hi, I was trying to decide what would be a good choice of shrubs for the front of my home. My house faces north and does not have full sun. Actually, very little sun except in the early morning. He's frustrated because all of the shrubs that he's looked at in the nursery say full sun. So he's asking us, what would my choices be in terms of finding shrubs that are going to do well on this north side of his house that does not get very much sun at all?
I like one especially called the Caria, which is a yellow-blooming plant that does really pretty well in the shade. It'll fool you because it looks like it ought to only be in the sun. But it can get pretty good size and do a pretty good job. Of course, the bottle brush buckeye, again, that can get 6 or 8 feet tall, but that'll do very well in the shade. There's some hydrangeas I like. They may not bloom quite as well in the shade, but the variegated leaf sometimes is all you want anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend maybe some variegated hydrangeas. There's one called Lakothia I like. It's kind of a wild child sort of thing, but this time of year it looks pretty good. And then there's a conifer called Cephalotaxis that does very, very well in the shade.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like a U, and it can grow upright or out either one. So that's some choices. How about you?
Yeah, and that's a good range of like different foliage interests,
right,
and some bloom, some not blooming, because you'll kind of need to take a look at some of those things to see what appeals to you because there's different styles. As basic as you can get, boxwood and taxus will do fine in shade. But if you want something a little different, let's see, mahonia do well in shade.
Mm-hmm.
The nandina do well in shade. Itea, Virginica does well in the shade as long as it's moist, right?
Right.
Abelia has a nice little sort of breezy little bloom.
I
and
like
it does fine in the shade.
Yeah.
Hydrangeas, but more of the woody hydrangeas, Bob, I was thinking like the oakleaf hydrangea,
yeah,
which is always on the top of my list for sun or shade, actually a very versatile plant, oakleaf hydrangea. And then also the hydrangea arborescens, the Annabelle hydrangea, will also do well. So there's a bunch of different things that will do okay in the shade, we promise.
Yeah.
You just have to sort of seek them out.
Annabelle does well in a box, actually.
So. Yeah. It's a good plant.
Yeah, it really is just guaranteed blooms on that
yeah.
one.
All right, here's another question from Sean in Harrison County, Indiana. I have about four trees I believe to be white pines, and they have some kind of root fungus problem. I first noticed there was an issue when their needles began turning brown and dying back. There are no cankers or conks on the trees that I have noticed, and to my knowledge, there's been no past root trauma or injury. There are several moles, however, at work extensively in the surrounding soil. A good sign, really, because it means you've got good soil. This fungus is producing small yellow spongy mushrooms appearing right above the root system. Their size is about 2 to 3 inches tall with a cap. I would obviously like to treat for them, but from what I have been reading online, there's no known treatment. Do we have any advice in terms of what's going on? Because they don't want to lose these trees.
Yeah, from what we know, that sounds normal.
It's
pine trees lose their needles, inside needles this time of year. Now, if it's the outer needles
of the tree. It's pretty uniform throughout the whole tree right now at home.
But the tips will be green.
Well, I mean, but it's like uniform throughout.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. But if the tips are brown, you got problems. If it's inside, that's just the way they lose their leaves, so to speak. So other trees do the same thing.
Right. And the fact that we've had such a rainy season, it's a fabulous mushroom season.
Mm-hmm.
Those are not like anything you need to treat. Root material decays on a regular basis, even with the healthiest of a tree. And those mushrooms are just happily living there, not stressing anybody out or doing anything wrong. I would just, Andy calls them little fairy villages.
Yeah, they could be kind of cute.
I would enjoy them. And I would also recommend looking around, don't you think, Bob? Look around and pay attention to what's happening in other places.
Right.
And then it comforts you because you realize, oh, wait a minute, that must be kind of a normal thing because white pines are shedding their needles everywhere. And look at all the mushrooms. I mean, at home, that's exactly the scenario. So if you're in trouble, I'm in really big trouble. And I think we're not in trouble. So there, okay?
Fair enough. If you have a rooty question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, to be agrarian, it means pertaining to farming and agriculture, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And it also pertains to land ownership and equitable land distribution.
Yes.
How about that? In
Perfect.
Terms of what we've talked about today, mm-hmm. I think it makes a whole lot of sense. So the Latin word of the week this week is agraria, agrarium, or agrarius.
Meaning growing in the fields.
Growing in the fields.
Wow, lilies right? in the field.
Yeah. Well, almost more like cultivated sort of, you know, field thing. I got to thinking about this, too, when we talked to Michael Gage last week. And remember how he was telling us a sign of an area that had been cultivated, you know, like plowed as in a field
right.
in that agrarian sort of way.
Yeah.
That when you start to see a lot of cedars come up in certain areas, you know that that field had previously been plowed.
Yep.
So that would be sort of an agrarian sort of indication as well. All right. Other plants that would probably grow in this situation, Agapodium podagraria.
The ground elder.
Ground elder.
That means old ground, right?
Yeah, but podagraria, so like that would be more like pod, like feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Agraria, so low growing kind of ground cover. Do you get it?
Ground elder.
Okay. Barbula agraria.
Barbula moss.
Barbula moss. So moss that would typically show up after an area's been
Plowed or worked over.
Exactly. Trifolium agrarium.
Ooh, golden clover.
Golden clover. There's so many different types of clover. Yeah. Euphorbia agraria.
Urban spurge.
Urban spurge sounds like so dreadful, doesn't it?
Yeah, and invasive.
And it is.
Right.
Spurge is one of those things that comes up in spurts. The worst possible yeah. place that you could think that a plant would even be able to survive.
And stays there.
And stays there, exactly. Yeah. So if you see Agraria, Agrarium, or Agrarius, something about that plant in terms of its nature, in terms of where it likes to grow, growing in fields, so typically, you know, out in areas that have been cultivated in the past and sort of left on their own later.
Works for me.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, a natural winemaker in France has roots in Louisville. He pays us a visit.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost, a man often outstanding in his field, at the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.